Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
The charge the AFL-CIO devotes too much of its resources to political lobbying and not enough to building up union membership. Joe Valenti heads up the largest Teamsters local in Michigan. Today, he roundly criticized AFL-CIO President John Sweeney and said American labor needs a new direction.
Sweeney dumps millions into the Democratic Party. Obviously, it's not working. Let's dump millions into organizing new members. We'll gain our political strength faster that way.
John Sweeney today called the defections a grievous insult to labor's rank and file. They are a stinging blow for a battered union movement struggling to stop membership losses and adapt to a rapidly changing global economy, where even a rebounding economy hasn't brought good wages. Back in the 1950s, one out of every three private sector workers were union. Today, that number is just one in ten. Tonight on Point, the historic split unfolding right now in the AFL-CIO and the future of organized labor when the economy is up but wages are down. We begin tonight in Chicago with the very latest developments. Steve Franklin is labor writer for the Chicago Tribune. Steve, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a sense of this day in Chicago? What was the theater of all these announcements like there?
Well, it was climatic and historic and some would say highly hopeful, others would say terribly tragic. The folks would say tragic were those who gathered here. This is the 50th anniversary of the AFL-CIO. And the point was to celebrate its founding. Those folks who are so upset about what's happened see this as a break in labor solidarity and say, even though unions are in terrible times and terrible troubles, it's not the time to quit. Just the reverse is the view of the two unions that today quit the AFL-CIO, and that's the Teamsters and the service employees. And their point is that the status quo doesn't work, they're wasting the money, and they need to go on their own.
It's being described as the biggest kind of schism in the labor movement since the 1930s. Exactly what happened today, Steve?
Well, they basically said, we're out of the AFL-CIO, don't forget our dues, and that accounts for $20 million of the $96 million, which is a pinch for the AFL-CIO, and 3.1 million members of the union, the AFL-CIO's 13 million members. This is going to hurt a bunch of people in different ways, and it'll help others in different ways. It'll hurt at the top the AFL-CIO, which needs the money, and their argument is they need the solidarity. In places across the country where we have things called labor councils, this creates a real problem, because the point of view of the AFL-CIO is that if these unions no longer belong to us, you can't cooperate with them. So if you have a Teamster in your town or a service employee in town, and these are large, active unions, that means they will not donate money, they will not take part in organizations, and some local labor councils may go out of business, and some may go bankrupt, and some may be suffering. At the same time, there are those who say, well, let's not get so worried about it, because things have not done well for labor, even though they've tried to change their ways. This may bring new life. It's better than nothing. And if this, what we expect to see happen is that there's a seven-member coalition. Others will follow. They'll form their own. They've already talked about it. They're going to collect money, create their own federation, sort of.
This is the so-called Change to Win federation?
They'll set that up. And so others say, well, you know, let's give them a chance. If they win, if they're successful, we're going to have two groups in the United States trying to organize people, trying to get a voice out. That's better than one organization limping along. You know, my own point of view is that whatever's happened here, what I see is that at least both sides are talking about, you know, ways of keeping unions alive. And 10 years ago, such conversations didn't take place.
Steve, we've got a bit of tape here I want to play from Andrew Stern. He's president of the Service Employees International Union, was a longtime protege of John Sweeney, now clearly has broken with him. Some have described this as, in some dimensions, a personal contest between Andy Stern and John Sweeney. He was with us on the show in March, taking on the AFL-CIO then, and explained some of his thinking about why they were approaching maybe a fork in the road. Let's listen to Andrew Stern, who led the walkout today.
The world has changed. We don't have local employers, we have national and international employers. We don't have a national economy, we have a global economy. And yet the structures of the AFL-CIO are old, outdated, and they need to be modernized and made new. So the first question is, what do you believe? The second question is how you do it. And too many labor leaders have nice jobs and nice titles and don't want to make the kind of changes that are necessary for their members to be successful, and I think that's morally wrong.
Andrew Stern, president of the Service Employees International Union, speaking with us here on Point March 3rd this year. Steve Franklin in Chicago. John Sweeney's supposed to be reelected to another term. He's been in, what, a decade now at the head of the AFL-CIO, 71 years old. Is there any doubt that with the remaining membership he'll be back in office?
No, there's no question it's impossible because they've pulled out. There's no opposition candidate. He has all the votes, and it's the party's over as far as that happens.
And what is it that these dissident renegade unions wanted that Sweeney couldn't or wouldn't deliver?
The real bottom line is they wanted Sweeney came a long way towards what they wanted, but not enough. They wanted much more money spent on organizing. They wanted at least half of the money that unions contribute to the FLCIO and dues, which is a total of $96 million given back to unions so they can organize. And Sweeney didn't do that. He offered to give back about 30%, but he stopped at that. On other areas, though, he did make some changes. There's also, and you have to look at it this way, there is the issue of discontent with Sweeney. They wanted somebody else, and they were unhappy that he's continuing. That was an issue that wasn't resolved.
But above all, driving this today, the down and down and down declining union membership. Steve Franklin in Chicago, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks.
Steve Franklin, labor writer for the Chicago Tribune and author of Three Strikes, Labor's Heartland Losses and What They Mean for Working Americans. He spoke with me from Chicago. We are talking tonight about the historic split unfolding right now in the AFL-CIO, now outside the AFL-CIO. You can join the conversation. Did the AFL-CIO need to rupture to regain momentum for the labor movement? Or is this a disaster for labor? And union listeners, are you with the rebels or with Sweeney? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. One of the peculiarities of the U.S. economy right now is that while overall it grew at 3.7% in the first quarter, 2005, a good pace, wages grew at just 2.4%, the slowest rate in 20 years. Joining me now from Los Angeles to look at this backdrop to today's union fireworks is Daniel Mitchell, professor at the Anderson School of Management and the School of Public Affairs at UCLA. From 1979 to 1990, he was director of the UCLA Institute of Industrial Relations. He's former chief economist of the Pay Board. Daniel Mitchell, thanks for being with us tonight.
Happy to be here.
So we're going to look at what's going on inside the union movement, but this gap between economic growth and wage sluggishness seems to be a key factor here. Why is this happening? Why the economy up and wages lagging?
Well, there are a number of causes. Some are kind of technical. There have been changes in the way we measure productivity and real output that are somewhat different from the past, so that some of that gap between wages and measured productivity is more of a technical kind of an issue.
But, do you doubt that the gap is there, that it's real?
No, I don't doubt it. It's there, but it's somewhat overstated compared to some of the historical evidence that people look at where productivity and wages kind of move together. I think another factor, though, is in part what you've been talking about, the change in the union movement that went on for many decades up to this present point where this crisis within the union movement took place. At one time, if you go back to the 1950s, you had a very influential labor movement, and pretty much if you were a non-union employer, Even though you didn't sign union contracts and have to live up to union wage scales and so on, you kept an eye out in terms of what the union sector was doing in terms of wages and benefits and working conditions, because perhaps just defensively, you didn't want to be unionized.
So unions set benchmarks, in effect.
They sort of set a benchmark. It wasn't that everybody mechanically just paid what the auto workers paid, but it had an influence on the way people who set wages in the non-union sector and set benefits and so on, how they went about it. And as the union movement shrank relative to the size of the overall workforce, which starts roughly in that period in the mid-1950s and then continues and accelerates into the 1980s and to the present day, unions became less and less influential. And today, you know, if you're a large non-union employer, let's say you're running a bank or something like that, you're not going to really pay much attention to what's going on in the union sector.
And what about the globalization of the economy? What about that side of the equation? We've just got half a minute before the break, but which in your view has been more influential in this flattening of wages? Unions declining clout or global competition?
Well, there are two sides to global competition. One is the direct export-import kind of competition that we talk about, and the other is immigration, another form of international competition. And both of those have a tend to have a depressing effect on wages. We're importing from countries that have much lower wage scales than are prevalent in the U.S., and, of course, we're bringing in labor from abroad, much of which is at the lower end of the labor market in terms of skills and education and wage scales, and so that tends to have a depressing effect too. And it also makes it more difficult for unions to organize, which set the stage for some of the problems in Chicago.
Daniel Mitchell at UCLA in Los Angeles joining us tonight. Please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about the future of organized labor in a country where the economy is up and wages are not. You can join us. Why are American corporate profits excellent and American wages essentially flat? Is bigger union membership the answer? Would bigger American labor unions turn wages around or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide, and by Corey McPherson Nash, a design firm developing branding, print, and interactive communication solutions, thoughtful design embedded in creative strategy.
Are you with the Rebels or with John Sweeney? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight from Los Angeles by Daniel Mitchell, professor at the Anderson Graduate School of Management at UCLA. We're joined right now from Worcester, Massachusetts, by Gary Chasen. He is professor of labor relations at Clark University and author of Unions and Legitimacy. Gary Chasen, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
So, huge rupture today, biggest it's being described is since 1930. What's your interpretation of what's going on here, Gary?
My interpretation is that this creation of a dissident movement is a result of both personal ambition on the part of the leaders of the dissident unions, and I think also their frustration, their personal ambition in the sense that they see themselves being blocked off from leadership positions in the AFL-CIO, and they think of themselves, and rightfully so, as very talented and energetic and imaginative union leaders.
And here you're talking about Andrew Stern at the Service Employees Union.
Andrew Stern and James Hoffer in particular, John
Teamsters.
Wilhelm.
John Wilhelm at Unite Here, the restaurant and hotel restaurant garment workers union. Yeah.
Right, Joe Hansen from the food and commercial workers. These are all very talented union officers, but I think also there's a very strong frustration, and it's a frustration that 10 years ago, with the election of John Sweeney and his slate of officers, everything seemed to be turned around and the Federation would be re-energized. And I think what they've seen over the last 10 years is just more of the same. That is a continuation, not even a stopping of the hemorrhaging of membership, but a continuation of it. A loss of 900,000 members in 10 years and a continuous decline of the proportion of the workforce in unions. So I think it was dashed expectations about a revival that led to this, along with a feeling that this were desperate measures, that they couldn't stand by and let this continue. and there needed to be something dramatically done to stop it before it was too late and before all measures proved to be useless.
And what do you think? Taking a close focus here for a minute, do you agree with the rebels that John Sweeney's leadership has failed to take the right steps? I mean, clearly, membership has continued to fall, so it hasn't had the effect of growing. But is it obvious that he did the wrong things?
No, I don't agree with the dissident group at all. I think you have to recognize who does organizing. The Labor Federation is an organization of unions, an association of unions. It doesn't have members, it doesn't bargain for them, and it doesn't organize them. The most that Sweeney could do is exhort the members exhort the affiliated unions leaders to organize and to allocate funds for that. If little organizing was done, and little has been done in those last 10 years, it's the fault of union leaders, okay, who didn't want to use their resources for that rather than the Federation.
Daniel Mitchell, of course, the Renegade group says, no, we need some of the resources that we're pouring into the AFL-CIO turned back to us to give us the cash to go out and do this organizing. Where do you put the blame for the flat and falling numbers in the last decade?
Well, you know, it's interesting to note that in 1935, when the AFL and the CIO split into two parts, that was a period of great growth, in part because of all the competition that went on between the AFL-affiliated unions and the CIO-affiliated unions.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1955, when the two former rivals joined into the AFL-CIO, that also happens to be the point at which union membership as a proportion of the workforce was at its peak, and thereafter it began to erode and decline and then get us to the present day. So there is something to be said for the notion that if you've got competition, different ideas, different organizations competing with one another, that energizes and maybe gets rid of some of the dead wood on both sides of the dispute and may energize the movement toward more organizing. So it isn't really clear that having some competition between rival groups, whatever their formal positions might be, is going to turn out to be a bad thing for organized labor taken as a whole.
Gary Chasen, how about it? Of course, back in the 30s, the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, represented elite craft workers. The CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations, was trying to unionize mass production workers in automobiles, steel, other industries. A fairly clear distinction then. Now it seems more a matter of posture and strategy than the industries that these unions are based in. If I read this right, do you think that this split could crank up competition, could lead to a revival of union membership, or is that all history?
I don't think so, and I think you have to be very cautious about the interpretation of the historical record. What happened in 1935 was the period of a Great Depression, worker receptiveness towards collective action, the passage of very permissive and protective labor legislation, and a great energizing of a labor movement under a charismatic leader. We're talking about John L. Lewis.
And yeah.
It's considerably different than the situation. Don't forget, they weren't concerned about globalization. They didn't have laws which hurt them, okay, at that time, as the labor law does right now by making organizing difficult. And we have a different type of a workforce now. Okay, in those days, there was a huge reservoir of unorganized workers in manufacturing who could be gotten if unions could be designed to approach them. We don't have that anymore.
So it's a big, tough challenge. I want to turn to Chicago for a moment right now. Anna Berger joins us from there. She is chair of the Change to Win Coalition, the umbrella group of unions who have left or are considering leaving the AFL-CIO. She's also secretary-treasurer of the Service Employees International Union. We'll hear later tonight from president of a union who's sticking with John Sweeney and the AFL-CIO. Anna Berger, thanks for being with us from Chicago tonight.
It's great to be with you.
A big day, a day of revolt, of schism in the American labor movement. How do you think this is going to help bolster American union membership?
I actually think this is a great day for labor. We're about building power for working people again, and I think that yesterday with our president conference and today, that we're actually moving forward to build and to organize workers so they can have a voice again.
How does splitting the labor movement, dividing it, make it stronger?
Well, reality is I think that labor leaders on both sides of this debate all believe and want the same thing for working people. They want people to have a decent job, be able to have health care and good pensions and have a better life for their kids. The reality is we have very different fundamental strategies for doing that. We believe that you need to talk to workers and organize workers in this country again so they can have a voice and win, as opposed to spending more time talking to politicians. We think that now is the time to organize workers and that there are lots of workers out there who want a union, who desperately need a union. You know, right now in America, many people are working longer hours and earning less. They, some people have to work 2 and 3 jobs to try to keep a roof over their head. They struggle to pay the rent. They worry about whether they have breakfast or have bus fare. Right now in this country, workers are worried that their children will have a worse life than they do. We think it's now time to organize again and that there are core industries in our country that need to be organized.
John Sweeney today called this a tragedy for working people. He said it comes at a time when our corporate and conservative adversaries, that is, of the labor union movement, have created the most powerful anti-worker political machine in the history of our country. He's driving home there again the point that you've got to change the political framework or you won't be able to organize effectively. What do you say to that?
And I say that we can't change the political format unless we organize workers. We need more union members in this country who have a voice, who can speak out, step up and speak out about the issues that are critical to them. And then we can change politics. The truth is, if we had more union members in Ohio, there would have been different results in Ohio in the last election. We believe that workers want a union, need a union, and that the labor movement can change their lives.
If you didn't have the resources within the AFL-CIO, how do you have it as a breakaway group?
Well, we said, and one of our proposals was, that we needed to put real resources into organizing, that we had to have unions focus on their core industries, and that we needed to have standards of accountability to hold ourselves accountable to each other in terms of organizing. We are committed to putting real resources into additional resources into organizing. You know, each of our unions, or 7 unions that are now part of the Change Coalition, are committed. They're unions that are changing. You know, the world has changed, the economy changed, our employer changed, and our unions have all confronted that and have changed and are putting more resources into organizing every day.
I wonder how bitter this might become. Linda Chavez-Thompson, John Sweeney's running mate for Executive Vice President AFL-CIO, said just went after several groups that she said have sought to weaken labor. She said the Bush administration, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Walmart, and then she added your group, the Change to Win Coalition. This is dukes up.
And so, you know, I understand that Linda might be bitter, but, you know, 10 years ago when I ran John Sweeney's, Richard Trumka and Linda Chavez Thompson's campaign to be president and the offices of the AFL-CIO, which I did, I had real hope that they would revitalize the labor movement, but things slowed down, and it's become very clear that we were going in the wrong direction. We used to represent, when I was a little girl 50 years ago, 1 in 3 workers were in a union. When you had a union card and a union job, you could raise a family on one job. Through your union, you won health care and pensions. Kids like me could go to have a better chance in life. Now there's 1 in 12 in our union. People need a union and want a union.
So what's a reasonable yardstick to hold your new effort to? If we look at it 10 years from now, if it's 8% of the private workforce today, where are you saying it should be? Where are you saying you can get it?
I don't know. I haven't looked at that number. I do know that with our Change to Win Coalition members, we have come together today in our first meeting since we decided not to go to the AFL-CIO convention to focus on organizing together. We will be building a strategic center for organizing where we will take the power from each of our unions together to take on some multinational corporations that we need to organize. And we just began that work today. So we are, you know, SEIU is an example. In 1996, since 1996 when Andy Stern became president, we have changed our union, focused on our core industries, put real resources into organizing, and we have organized 900,000 new workers, just our union alone. A month and a half ago, after a 10-year campaign, we organized 49,000 child care providers in Illinois. It took a lot of work, and it took resources and strategy and a long-term commitment, but we did it. And we will organize more child care providers across this country as well. We, a few weeks after that, organized 42,000 home care providers in the state of Michigan. So I believe that by us all working together, by us being strategic and putting resources into it and having long-term commitment to working people in this country, we can organize them, give them a voice, and that we can actually change our country again.
Anna Berger, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Anna Berger joined us from Chicago. She is the chair of the Change to Win Coalition. That is the breakaway group that has today brought the biggest schism since the 30s to the AFL-CIO, to the American labor movement. Also joining us right now from Chicago, from the other side of this gap that's opening, this chasm that's opening up today, James Williams. He's general president of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. Union represents over 140,000 men and women in the U.S. and Canada. He's a member of the AFL-CIO Executive Council and its Executive Committee. James Williams, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So, a big day, and I have to imagine from your perspective, a bad day.
Well, you know, it's like organizing. When you go out some days, you work real hard, you try to organize somebody, and nothing goes right. And other days, things just fall into your lap. So, you know what? We got to address the situation that's at hand. We weren't in control of the situation. If someone wants to go, they went. Now we have to address what's going on right now.
You've got a big chunk of AFL-CIO membership that's gone or reportedly about to go. What's it going to mean for the labor union movement in America? Does it revive it through competition, or is this a disaster?
Well, I think what we need to do, and I think it's something that we've done in our organization, is we need to talk to our current members. The members that we have in the union, I mean, you know, the numbers that were announced at the AFL-CIO convention today, that over the last number of years, 9 million more members came into the union. But that meant that we also lost members. So what are we doing if we're not talking to our current members? What are we missing? So I think this gives us an opportunity to focus in on each one of our union memberships, get back and talk to our members. I think that's a key.
But this seems to kind of go to the critique. We just heard from Anna Berger. We heard it earlier from Andy Stern. They're saying it's not enough to keep your core membership intact. You've got to go out and bring in new workers.
We got to also work the political arena. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that, you know, it don't matter how many people you organize if you're losing more out the back door than is coming in the front. You need a combination of both.
And what about the critique? We heard it again today from James Hoffa, head of the Teamsters, saying we've got to have more union members in order to change the political climate. Their critique is that the AFL-CIO has put too much money straight into politics without building its base, so it's got real numerical clout.
Well, you know, I agree with Jimmy on a lot of things, and you know, I admire Jimmy as a president of an international and work very closely with him. And I agree with him that we have to do a whole lot of things different. And I believe a lot of the organizations in the AFL-CIO are about to do that. Some of them are already doing that. I know that the coming together, the circling of the wagons, and what we have in front of us is pure grassroots politics within our own organization. And then we have to put up our organizing campaign. We're going to address the resolutions that were discussed over the last 3 months, and we're going to move those resolutions and adopt those resolutions the rest of this week.
But are you going to have a divided labor movement in America for the next, 5, 10, 20 years? What it looks like tonight.
We have no control. We have no control over the Win to Change organization. What we have control over is the AFL-CIO, and we have a vested interest in the CLCs and the central bodies and the state feds, and we're going to work with our state feds, and we're going to work with our CLCs, and we're going to build the labor movement one member at a time. And that's how you have to organize. When this happened in the 30s, and you go back to the 30s is when John L. Lewis walked away. And there was nobody stronger than John L. Lewis at that particular time. So there's dynamics involved as far as leadership is concerned. I know one thing. That we're going to work together for the members we represent, no matter what it takes, and that's really all that matters. We got to get, you know, I listened to a little bit of what was on today, as far as the other speakers, and you know, I know myself. I go back to my high school. I've gone back for the last 25 years. I talk to the people in the neighborhoods in Philadelphia. And I used to ask the question when I went into career days: how many people in here, both parents, work? Well, 25 years ago, maybe a spattering of hands come up. Now, there might be one or two hands in that high school that both parents don't work. So I think it's you know, I mean, we had a change in economic times in the construction industry. We had a change in the evolution of how jobs are being done today.
Can unions answer that? And if they can, why haven't they under John Sweeney?
I think it's up to each individual union. And 10 years ago, when John Sweeney took over, it's ironic because, you know, Anna was the whip and the person in charge of the Sweeney campaign. I was a whip alongside of her, you know, trying to put the Sweeney team together and get him elected in New York City. And there's so many good people in the AFL-CIO. There's so many strong leaders. And I don't take this personal. I don't have a problem in the world with any of the leaders of the Wind to Change Coalition. Okay, they made a decision based upon what they thought was right for their membership. I know one thing. The rest of the labor movement made a decision what was based upon what was right for their union. And I think that's what it comes to. I mean, you know, it's really that simple.
But
we're all leaders.
Yeah, I hear that, but there's the overall issue of the American worker out there, and do you think the future looks better or worse tonight, Mr. Williams?
I think it depends upon that organization. I don't think it looks any worse. I mean, you know, today we had some you know, fantastic speakers here that talked about the issues that are right before the House this week, CAFTA,
mm-hmm.
and what it's done. I think the education of our members is a key. Our membership don't know. I know that the Ohio situation, as Anna said, if we had another 40,000-50,000 members and a few hundred thousand votes there, we could have turned that around. But you know what? That was the same thing we said in Florida.
Mr. Williams, I know we have to let you go. We thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. Have a nice day.
You too. James Williams, General President of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, member of the AFL-CIO Executive Committee, putting a brave face on there tonight. Gary Chasen, Daniel Mitchell, please stick with us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, bicon.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services.
Make more sense or less. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'd like to get some response from our two guests tonight to the two labor leaders that we just heard from in Chicago. Daniel Mitchell, first to you. James Williams there putting a brave face on a pretty rough day.
Well, I think so. One thing that wasn't mentioned was that within the construction trades, you have the Carpenters Union, and they've also been somewhat of a dissident, pulled out of the AFL-CIO and dissatisfied with the way that organization has been functioning.
They're being called one of the seven that are bolting. They're already gone.
Sure. So you've got a group of unions that are quite influential within the labor movement, have a lot of members, and are not happy with the way things are going. And when they say, you know, things can't get much worse for organized labor, they have it right. In the private sector, you have just a steady downward trend with no sign of a reversal or even a bottoming out.
Gary Chasen, Anna Berger there with the Change to Win coalition, the breakaway coalition, as it were, not bad-mouthing anybody, but just saying we're going to do it better. We can. I thought I heard you saying earlier that's going to be tough.
Well, I wish you had been more candid, actually. It's very easy to talk about energizing and new plans, mm-hmm. and foresight and what your goals are. And it's, the talking points are very many, but what's missing there is the real figures on what it takes to do it. It costs about $1,000 to organize each new union member. It takes about 500,000 new members per year just for the labor movement to stand still.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that a renewed labor movement, an invigorated labor movement, should have to organize 1 million members per year for at least 5 or 10 years in order to show that it's regained its influence. And even then, organizing 1 million members per year is not even coming close to what its membership was 20 years ago.
I was trying to get her to commit to some kind of target like that. Of course, she was not.
The money isn't there, okay? And what they're talking about, $50 million here or $20 million, it doesn't work. And the way in which she divorced politics from organizing was somewhat disingenuous also, because the service employees used political influence in order to get home health care workers reclassified,
mm-hmm.
from independent contractor to employee and then unionized. And in fact, many of the most recent gains of membership in the service employees has been either through union mergers or by taking in workers that they were able to get reclassified as employees through their political clout.
So if they know the same numbers that you're citing here, but that it costs $1,000 per new recruit to the union, to the unions...
That's a conservative estimate.
And if the money's not there and there's no clear way for it to be there, what do you think is motivating this?
Well, I think the money is there, but it requires a hard decision that unions would have to spend anywhere from a third to half of their budgets on organizing new members.
Isn't that their point? They're saying that's what we will do.
No, that's not what they're saying. That's what they're saying. That's what they've done. Okay, but they seem to be turning to a federation in order to do this. And like I said before, a federation doesn't organize workers. Unions organize workers. To some degree, the criticism of the AFL-CIO is deflecting the criticism that should be directed at individual unions for not making the sacrifices over the years to organize new members when membership has been declining.
I want to begin to bring our callers in. Hugh is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Hugh. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks. What do you think?
Well, I think Mr. Swinney did a disservice to the union movement by not stepping aside. I think the coalition has some good strategy. But there's a real danger as they consolidate power at the top to fight large corporations that the locals are going to be losing power, and therefore the rank and file will be losing their democratic right to participate.
Hugh, are you suggesting that this breakaway coalition, Change to Win, is somehow less democratic than AFL-CIO members have historically been?
It seems like Mr. Wilhelm and Mr. Stern have been dismissive or indifferent or not concerned about that issue. And a number of people, including myself and the Association of Union Democracy, which is a watchdog of Union Democracy, are really concerned that the locals and the rank and file are going to be left out of this entire game.
What about, you heard Gary Chasen just saying that the locals haven't gotten off the dime and made the sacrifices and done the work to recruit new members. Maybe leadership is needed from the top down, or is that...
Well, yeah, of course it is, but... Again, you know, as the climate changes in the union world, I think that the locals might be left out of this situation. And as far as how they participated, I think they participate. That's been my experience.
Hugh, thank you very much for raising it. Let us look at it. Daniel Mitchell, how about it? A concern raised there about the level of democracy at the kind of grassroots level within the union locals here. Is it being challenged by the breakaway somehow?
Well, I do think that the unions like the SEIU have a kind of mixed strategy. On the one hand, I think the core strategy of their unions is made pretty much at the top, but they do try, once they have gotten local unions organized, to sort of spread a level of democracy within those local unions. The SEIU, I can tell you, here in California, the SEIU is a very influential player in terms of politics, and it's influential really independent of the AFL-CIO local and statewide entities. So they will go on doing their political organizing. The Justice for Janitors campaign started out here, which was partly labor organizing in the traditional sense and partly political organizing to get backing from key players in the local establishment. With the home care aides that was mentioned, I mean, that was done politically. But again, it was the SEIU doing it. They didn't really need to call anybody else in to make those political gains.
But a call there from our caller to keep union democracy healthy. Sherry's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Sherry, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I was just calling to maybe give an example of the vision shown by SEIU in terms of gaining political clout through organizing workers.
Let's hear it.
SEIU has responded to outreach from the Employees Association of North Carolina. It's an independent association in a right-to-work state with no collective bargaining laws for public workers, and they formed a five-year partnership with the organization I work for, the State Employees Association, in an attempt to grow the membership in the Association of State Workers and also organize local government employees in an attempt to gain collective bargaining law and actually build political power for workers in North Carolina.
Is it working, Sherry? Do they have a different approach than you've seen before?
I have seen evidence of it working, and they are in no way divorcing organizing members from politics based on my experiences, in that they enabled the partnership enabled our association to make a big impact on legislative elections, legislative races in the last election cycle. And they're working very hard to organize members to pressure lawmakers. It's very much, it's a dual strategy. It seems that they feel like that the political clout will be gained through membership growth. And I think in the 2 years that they've been in North Carolina partnering with the State Employees Association, I have seen a difference.
So there's a vote of confidence for the sort of core union in the breakaway group. Sherry, thanks very much for calling. Gary Tyson, let me put the big question back to you again here. We see what's happened with American wages. It's kind of flat line. They've been on very slow growth, slowest in 20 years. Daniel Mitchell warns us to watch out for the way statistics have been interpreted over time there, but there seems to be a consensus that while the economy is pushing ahead pretty strongly, wages have not kept pace, profits up handsomely, wages not. What's your interpretation of why this is happening?
My interpretation is that we've got a return to the concessionary bargaining that we saw in the early 80s, and quite frequently, unions are on the defensive rather than the offensive in negotiations, trying to protect past gains, particularly in health care benefits, pensions, work rules.
But what's the reason? Is this because we're facing cheaper competition abroad? Is it because we don't have a strong, a well-educated American workforce that can justify those wage rates?
No, I think the globalization is a huge, huge problem that casts a shadow over all of this, and the unions have not figured out how to deal with international competition. They can't stop it, and they can't live with it. Okay? It creates tremendous competitive pressures on American employers. It presents an alternative to employers if they don't like their labor costs in the United States. It provides a way in which strikes can be defeated. And it siphons off union members that have to be replaced through new and expensive organizing.
How does it siphon off union members? Why?
A large proportion of the union membership losses are lost because of the closing of plants in the United States.
Oh, I see.
And relocation
right.
overseas. And
so
in order to just stand still, those mm-hmm. members have to be replaced through organizing.
To keep up with that churn. So let's say that this breakaway group is somehow effective. Let's say that they're really good at recruiting, and instead of 8% of private sector workers in union, miraculously a decade from now it was 20%. Would that make America more competitive or not? Would it could they squeeze better wages out, or would the jobs just be lost?
Many of the employees who are represented by the dissident unions are not those who are directly affected by globalization, except for Unite, which is part of Unite here. Hotel workers, grocery store workers,
right.
Teamsters, truck drivers, laborers are only indirectly affected by that.
Because you can't move the truck driver's job overseas. You've got to drive the truck on American roads.
Right, and you can't move the grocery store overseas if you don't like the wages, okay, even though there are other competitive forces that are operating there. They really haven't felt the brunt of the forces that have affected many of the unions staying within the AFL-CIO, particularly the steel workers and the auto workers and the machinists.
Daniel Mitchell, of course, we note then that it's those who have felt the brunt who are sticking with the AFL-CIO here.
Well, I think it's not an accident that unions like the SEIU have been organizing in areas that are not directly in global competition. I think that's part of their strategy. They look for sectors of the economy which are protected from that sort of competition, and that's their immediate strategy. So they're not claiming that they have an answer to the auto workers' problems or the steel workers' problems, but what they are saying is there are an awful lot of workers in the domestic sector, if you like, in retail, in transportation, in construction, in hotels, and all those sorts of places, who are not organized and could be organized, and they're asking why those people are not being targeted.
So, but how much good does it do for American workers overall if these unions can only organize those whose jobs can't be exported? Does that really help bump up American wages overall?
Well, at a time, you know, if you go back again to the heyday of unions, people would have said that, well, it's the auto workers and the steel workers. Those are the people who are working for the big corporations that can afford higher wages and benefits. And so unions went there, and they organized there, and they pulled up wages there. And it did have some indirect effect on areas like retail and service and so on. As a sort of a spillover effect. So I think that's really what they're looking at. They're not really claiming that they have an answer to every problem that could conceivably arise or that is obvious at the present time, but they're just saying that the current strategy isn't going to work. They are able to do their own political activity really without the AFL-CIO participation. So they're saying, if you can't help us in the sectors that we're interested in and in following the strategy we're interested in, we'll have to put our money someplace else.
John is calling from Livingston, Kentucky. Hello, John. You're on the air, my friend.
Yes. I'm just driving through, headed back to Ohio, and it makes me sick to my stomach to hear how the union bashing, we built the big business. My grandfather, my grandmother both retired from General Motors.
Mm-hmm.
And with all the gains in the 70s and the 80s with health care, they lived to be very old and lived happy lives.
Right.
And now I'm just tired of General Motors, Chrysler, Ford crying about the legacy costs that they have that Toyota and Nissan don't have.
They're saying that the cost of health care for retirees is sinking their ship. You think they're wrong, John?
It may be, but they can't put it on us. They cannot put it on the people that built that corporation. General Motors was the number one corporation in the world, and the people that supposedly someone just said uneducated or not educated enough, the fact is General Motors outsmarted the unions. They waited till the leadership. I'm speaking of the IUE because that's who I worked for.
Okay, yep.
General Motors IUE.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I no longer have a job there. But my grandmother and grandfather both retired from there, and my father worked there for a while. The fact is that they waited until the leadership either had 30 years or right at 30 or even past 30 and got all of these concessions to send this work overseas.
And off it went, and you say, let's remember who built the company up. John, thanks for your call. Gary Chasen, there's the perspective that says, look, we built this country. We built these big corporations, and how can they turn around on unions now? A fair perspective?
Well, I think there's even something more interesting in his comments, okay? And that is that tomorrow morning, a worker from General Motors is going to pick up his newspaper and read about Change to Win Coalition.
Right.
And say, how does this affect whether the UAW is going to be able to protect my health care benefits from General Motors' attempts to reduce its costs and regain its competitive position? Okay.
Change to Win would say, if we don't get more union membership in this country, nothing else is going to protect that, I guess.
And they're
going to
say, well, that's really nice, but, you know, I want to know what's going to happen tomorrow, okay? And I want a very concrete, pragmatic response to that. And I think that's where most workers are concerned, exactly what's going to happen at the bargaining table. And I think that there's an anger there, okay, that unions are on the defensive, and there's also a sense that they have to be on the defensive in order to save jobs in a changed economic environment.
We've just got half a minute, but is there an alternative to building up membership? Aren't you fighting a losing battle if you don't have the membership to swing some clout?
Exactly, okay. And so what has to be is a recognition that it's going to take a huge investment in time and energy and money, okay, in order to build up that membership, in order to have an impact on these economic conditions.
Mm. Gary Chasen, Daniel Mitchell, with that, we're out of time. I'm very grateful to each of you for being with us tonight. Gary Chasen, Professor of Labor Relations at Clark University, joining us tonight from Worcester, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Daniel Mitchell, thanks for taking us into these woods and helping us understand what's going on here. We're grateful to you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Daniel Mitchell, professor at the Anderson Graduate School of Management at UCLA. He was longtime director of the UCLA Institute for Industrial Relations. We heard earlier from Anna Berger, chair of the new Change to Win Coalition, and from James Williams, general president of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and and NPR, National Public Radio. Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, sponsoring new small rigorous high schools around the country that prepare students for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. The Pew Charitable Trust, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at PewTrusts.org. And the Kresge